All right, this is the Alembic Files. I'm Theo. Al is in the trainer's room. What we have Eric the Blacksmith, and we're talking about, a continuation of the series Phantasms of Freedom. And I know of several of the sources that Eric has been speaking of. Erica, remind me, where did we leave off?
Well, hello, Theo, and please give my regards to Al in the training room.
Yeah.
And, I left off with the Whiskey Rebellion, and there were several other aspects that I wanted to discuss, and there were a couple of Indian wars. Their names off the top of my head escapes me. And in a future installment, I'd certainly like to delve into more of that, but I wanted to discuss some more of the Whiskey Rebellion itself. And what happened was there were four counties in Pennsylvania that were very roused about Hamilton's tax on whiskey. And whiskey was it wasn't, of course, just a source of entertainment. It was a method of exchange. Barter was extremely prevalent in that era. And my feeling is that one of the reasons that the founding lawyers wanted to introduce specie was to interfere with the organic smoothness of barter.
Yeah. One of the few times in history that you had a totally successful debt-free currency was that Massachusetts Bay Colony. The Informers mentioned this too.
I was going to say the Informer did talk about that, yes.
And so does Emmanuel Josephson in the last book of that Strange Death of FDR book. And he recommends it, of course, for the future if we ever want to pull off a successful economy. Of course, it will never happen. But that's where the commodities are worth tangible. Basically, the commodities are money, too. So if you grow wheat, that's money. The staples of life. If you're a cattle farmer, if you have sheep, all of that.
Absolutely, and even charcoal back in the day. And as a blacksmith, I'm familiar with these methods. And colliers were guys who created charcoal. They would heap a whole bunch of fire, a bunch of wood, set it on fire, and then tamp it once a lot of the raw biomass was burnt off. And that was one of the commodities that was used. And, of course, the bituminous coal. But that was to come later. And, of course, you had leather, you had corn, you had soil, many things that were used. And this note, these Massachusetts Bay notes, if you had, say, 50 sheep, and this note was backed against those 50 sheep, 20 years later, 50 sheep, that's pretty hard to inflate.
Yeah, so by limiting what counts as money or currency as to specie or even worse, to paper money, you give all of the power to the bankers and you set them up as kings, basically, and everybody else has to bow down to them. But why do we do that? Because you think about it, in a sane, logical, rational, and fair system, the banker's got to eat. The banker's got to wear clothes. So if they're going to try to deprive you or play games with you with the metals or the money, try growing your own wheat then, banker.
Exactly. Well, and the bankers were certainly kissing cousins to the jobbers and the speculators, and perhaps the biggest and most successful land jobber was good old George Washington himself.
Sure was.
Several trips through the county of western Pennsylvania and Ohio, first when he was a youth, then as a soldier, and then he enforced his land rights. He made the last such visit in 1784, gave this guy, who was really a shrewd and imperious wealthy planter, he was an entrepreneur and surveyor, gave him immediate acquaintance with the characteristics of the land he was checking out. He was basically a ruthless land speculator, in the expanses that he saw that were very rich. He was always craving more.
And he had
eventually...
he had inside knowledge of what real estate was going to become important later on.
Absolutely. And he eventually held title to more than 63,000 Western acres, including 4,700 in southwestern Pennsylvania. And Al and I, we did a show not too long ago where I did go into more detail about old Georgie's holdings, which were just massive. In his day, he was equivalent to what might be Warren Buffett or Bill Gates or Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And he certainly had the same mindset. And it was interesting because not too long ago, in fact, earlier today, not too long ago, I heard this lecture that was given, I think, in Kansas, and it had to do with the Robert Dole Foundation, so you can get an idea right there of where this was going. And this professor was giving a public speech. It was moderated, I think. And I have to say that I was really kind of hoping for some more objective analysis, but it turned out to be what I termed before parchment worship.
Yeah.
And to be honest, it was kind of painful to listen to. I mean, I did get some tidbits from it, but I'm thinking to myself, the myths and the misconceptions just continue. And I want people to know that we're not here just banging on this country and just trying to throw turd pies at it. We're just trying to see things as they are. The scales have fallen from my eyes in many respects, and I'm trying to do a dispassionate analysis and to really look at the situation we're in and to scrape away all the fantasies of really what this country is and how we got where we are, and above all, how it started and the deceptive tactics that were used to start it, and deceptive tactics that are either painted over, ignored, or lied about today.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
so, go ahead, Al.
In Washington, he acquired this property. I was going to go back to Washington. And it was in a manner usual to most capital accumulators. In making and holding his purchases, he lied. He knowingly and repeatedly broke the laws of Great Britain, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. He cheated the soldiers under his command who trusted him. Now, naturally, that included taking the best lands for himself.
Yeah, and does that you get into Shays' Rebellion there?
Well, this here is the Whiskey Rebellion.
Okay.
Well, Shays' Rebellion was what, 1787, I believe. This was 1794.
Okay.
I believe it was 1794. He took the best lands for himself when he distributed land allocated to his command. He browbeat. He sued. And here's something that I think about. What about these huddled masses yearning to be free? Well, I would include these huddled masses yearning to be free, the squatters who were on the land. And here he is. Here's Washington breaking the law, and here he's exhibiting disgust at the lack of respect the quote, squatters had for the law, and he threatened. And Washington and other speculators, they were really becoming the most unpopular people, the most unpopular men in the Western country. And, of course, the West was considered much, you know, it was geographically, obviously, a very different spot than it is now. You know, the Western territory was Western Pennsylvania and into the Ohio Valley. And that's one reason a lot of these people moved West, was to basically get away from the confines and the enforcement of the new Constitution. And there was a lawsuit against immigrant squatters along Chartiers Creek, and this was where the later rebellion in Washington County took place. And it really fueled the image of Washington as a speculator and a landlord, a very grasping one at that. Now, there were some squatters. These were Scots they came into this country during the Revolution, and Washington visited this property in 1784, and they offered to pay for the land. You know, they told Washington about their hardships. They're determined to make the land they had into usable, arable land. You know, they cleared it and cultivated it into a worthwhile home. Well, Washington, he offered them a 999-year lease or sale over 3 years with interest. Well, these Scots, they couldn't afford it right away. They agreed to pay his price if he gave up the interest and allowed them more time. Well, Washington, not many people realize this, but Georgie Boy had anger issues.
Really?
A lot of time. Yes, he did. He had some serious anger issues, and he really tried his whole life to control his anger. And every now and then, his private secretary, I don't remember his name, he said there was no noise on earth like Washington cussing a blue streak. Well,
wow.
Washington, he very impatiently refused, got very angry. And I suppose these Scots let some of their own temper show, and they told him that they'd fight him in court. Well, most squatters couldn't afford to go to court, or they just backed down under Washington's, you know, evil eye.
Yeah.
Well, Washington exclaimed, "I'll have this land just as surely as I now have this handkerchief." So Washington storms out. He sues the Scots. An ejectment in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. And in 1786, okay, this was prior to the rebellion, okay? This was in 1786, he won. So the Scots and all of Washington's squatters, they were just thrown off the land. Now, Washington and these other absentee landlords, they monopolized much of the area's best land. And here you've got local farmers basically trying to scratch a living from what remained.
And so also the land does not get developed. The country does not grow.
Right.
That's a common pattern. Boy, that book that I refer to a lot by Gustavus Myers, The History of the Supreme Court of the United States, that tale gets told hundreds of times, I want to say, in that book, where the speculators come out, take advantage of some loophole in the law, and they just grab up all of these huge plots of land that, believe it or not, the government wanted to go to individual settling families so that the land could be developed and the country would be stronger. You know, they could fend off Indian attacks or other foreign attacks. But these speculators constantly undermined that.
Yes, they did. There was a congressman, Finley, and he did not like Washington or his administration, and he said that Hamilton deliberately brought on the insurrection. Well, there was a letter that Hamilton wrote to his sister where he said as much, that he's trying to get this whole thing going so they could probably practice the 1790s version of shock and awe.
Oh, no.
Now, there is a record that was... let's see. It was compiled in 1882, and it's by a Boyd Crumrine. That's BoydCrumrine. And it's over 1,000 pages long, and it's the history of Washington County, Pennsylvania, basically from its first settlements to, I'm assuming, the Civil War. I believe there is information about the Civil War. And the Whiskey Rebellion is talked about pages 262 to 306, and I will send you and Al the link to the PDF if you're interested.
Yeah, and that's a lot of pages.
Yes, it talks about the history of this county, and it goes into extreme detail, a lot of history that I certainly never learned in school, and he does invest a good 40, 50 pages in the Whiskey Rebellion.
That's about 49 more pages than they, 49 and three-quarter pages more than they teach you in school.
Indeed. And I wanted to go to my old standby, which is Hologram of Liberty, by Kenneth W. Royce, the second edition, he did augment the work. And there is an interesting chapter, and he talks about Hamilton. Now, Hamilton was a character and a half, and he has a chapter in the book. Let me see if I can find it here. And he asks the question, Hamilton, covert bankster agent? Let me see here. It's page 151.
Yeah,
actually, he wrote down some page numbers here, okay.
Bankster for Hamilton, bankster?
Yes.
Good for him.
Well, his attendance record was viewed with suspicion. And Robert Hendrickson in Hamilton 1, on page 483, he writes, quote, Hamilton was back in New York again in late August for mysterious and inscrutable reasons that must have come up quite suddenly. There is no other way to account for his rushing back to Philadelphia and forth to New York late again in August for only a week or so of not very consequential floor appearances, unquote. Now, you have I have here a chronological outline of Hamilton's attendance, and this is in Hologram Chapter 7, where he dedicates the whole chapter to Hamilton and asks, you know, what kind of connections did Hamilton have? What kind of motivations did he have? And it was interesting where here, you know, he asks, was Hamilton a covert agent for the banksters? Probably. Recall that at the young age of 23, he submitted his plan for a national bank to the Confederation Superintendent of Finance. 2 years later, he's complaining to the Confederate Congress that the Tories, British loyalists that is, can't get redress in state courts. He then began his post-war law practice as the Tories' foremost attorney in their lawsuits to recover confiscated property. He married into one of the most wealthy and blue-blood families in New York. He was a lifelong dedicated Anglophile and hauteur aristocrat. Though I've so far, and this is Royce here, I'm quoting him, though I've so far no direct evidence, and his personal papers of 1787 are, and he asks in parentheses purposely, utterly meager, to me it seems highly likely that Hamilton served as a vital emissary between the convention and interested banking powers in New York. Hard proof and some smoking gun is probably not forthcoming. If such a conspiracy did occur, as I suspect, then the actors naturally hid or destroyed their communications, unquote. And that brings me to the war. I wonder about the War of 1812. Were some of those documents destroyed during the War of 1812 when the Brits invaded Washington to put the kibosh on the original 13th Amendment?
That is one of the truly Twilight Zone-ish episodes in American history. That there was an original 13th Amendment, nothing to do with the 13th Amendment we know today. There was another one that got disappeared from history. And
absolutely.
You find this in the writings of James Montgomery. Those books are available online. The book, I think it shows up in both of his books. Let's see, that the United States is still a British colony, and the other book is A Nation Defeated in Victory. And he writes, when the Constitution was originally written, there's some provision that you could not hold any titles of nobility. But there's no teeth, there's no penalty if you did. And
that's correct.
There was this original 13th Amendment that put some teeth and actually declared that nobody can serve in Congress. You can't serve in government if you have a title of nobility, and that included lawyers because they are esquires, and that's a title of nobility. And so that was one reason for the War of 1812, according to Montgomery. The other reason is the National Bank that ultimately took monies and brought it over to England, just as before the Revolution. The National Bank charter was up, and the U.S., not the public at least, did not want to recharger that bank, and Britain said, oh, no, you don't. So for those two reasons, and so what you alluded to is that I've often thought it strange in history, Eric, when the British came, and I know the Canadians claim credit for this too, but it probably was a joint venture, but the British and perhaps the Canadians also came and invaded D.C., invaded the capital, and James and Dolly Madison had to flee for their lives in the middle of the night, and there's some legend how he was carrying the Constitution with him or something. But the Brits, they burned the White House, and this is how it came to be called the White House, because it was later painted white because of the charring. But then they left, and that seems so strange to me. There was no army from America forcing the British to leave. Why did they leave? So you're saying, as Montgomery was saying, that there may have been some burning, some disappearing of documents, namely, especially that original 13th Amendment.
Correct. And here you've got Hamilton, and I'll go over briefly some of his movings. And I mean, he seemed to be the 18th century version of Where's Waldo. The Philadelphia Convention from 18th of May to 28th of June. And you figure a three-day wagon ride in the day, stagecoach ride in those days, say, from it's probably about 100 miles, 98 miles from Philadelphia to New York City, 29th of June to the 1st of July en route to New York City, the 1st to 2nd of July probably in New York City, 3rd of July, New York City, he wrote to Washington, the 3rd to the 9th of July, he's still in New York City. Okay, and 11th to 13th of July, latest to be en route to Philadelphia. And on the 13th of July, he was in Philadelphia with an M. Cutler. The 14th to the 22nd of July, he was in, Philadelphia without, I assume he did not attend the convention at the time. And the 23rd to the 25th of July, latest to be en route to New York City. And I'll just add a note in here that Kenneth Royce, he does speculate on some of these motions. There is a lighter text and darker text. The lighter text are his speculations. The darker text are what he knows or has found in the records.
Mm-hmm.
And 26th of July to the 6th of August, he was in New York City, and he wrote various letters. 7th to 9th of August, en route to Philadelphia with Jerry. 9th of August, Philadelphia, no attendance. 10th to 13th of August, Philadelphia, no attendance. 13th of August, he was at the convention. 14th to 16th of August, latest to be en route to New York City. Now, on the 17th of August, he was in New York City with Jay. He was meeting with Justice Jay. 18th to 19th, he was still in New York City. The 20th of August, New York City wrote to Rufus King. 21st to 27th of August, still in New York City. 28th of August, in New York City, wrote again to Rufus King. 29th August to 2nd of September, he was still in New York City. 3rd to 5th of September, he was latest to be en route to Philadelphia. 6th to 17th of September, Philadelphia Convention. And the 18th to 20th of September, en route to New York City. I know that's a lot of dates and times, but it just gives you an idea as to just how busy this guy was, and it begs the question, who the hell was he meeting with?
Yeah. And especially, you stated that he was, what, 23 when he got...
Yeah, here you guys, 23 years of age, most young men, this is what Royce says, and I love this. At 23 years of age, most young men are out drinking and chatting up women. But no, Hamilton is cloistered away somewhere, shunning song and dance, drafting his national bank. Isn't it possible that 7 years later he had made himself known to, through his service on General Washington's staff and then in the New York legislature, powerful men in the banking circles? Does it not then follow that he then allied himself with such men and worked within the Committee of Style to further banking and mercantile interests? Jay even used Hamilton's Bank of New York to fund the new Congress's Federal Hall in New York City. Clearly, I am not making huge leaps here. The circumstantial evidence is abundant. My deductions seem reasonable, unquote. Now, Hamilton had 500 employees.
Wow. This becomes especially suspicious I think, Eric, when you look at his heritage, he did not have the aristocratic heritage, the birthing you would want, that these aristocrats would want. According to Emanuel Josephson in that book, The Strange Death of FDR, he writes a bit on Hamilton in there, and he says that Hamilton was born a mulatto, and that he was born in, the Bahamas, somewhere around there?
Somewhere in the Caribbean.
And then, and that also, you know, if you've been listening to what Al and JQ have been talking about, that area there was apparently some kind of hotbed then for secret societies.
Yes. Yes, and here you've got a guy, he was like the Energizer Bunny before and after the convention, and he was basically a dud during. So was this guy instructed to be restrained during the convention? You know, was he like a bulldog that was muzzled?
You never do hear bring that, do you?
No, and here he's an accomplished debater. He savored political hand to hand. He returns to the bench of silence following his well-timed outburst of the 18th of June. I think he talked for like 5 hours on the need for a bank. I do believe that the informer talked about that at some point. So, you know, here you've got this guy just kind of sitting in the background, and then I think he left home on the 28th or the 29th of June. But, yeah, here's a guy with 500 employees. 70 of them were in his own building. All right, now you had 20, less than 20 in the state and war departments combined.
Wow.
Yeah, so no. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said, that's telling.
Yeah, very much so. And, you know, is there evidence that could say that the banking elite created this corporate entity and painted a very thin veneer on it with the name United States, and then it would eventually absorb the entire USA?
Mm-hmm. And they had their lawyers meet in secret and lie about why they were meeting in secret. Oh, we're just going to tinker with the Articles of Confederation. Don't worry.
That's right. And there is evidence of a lot of obviously a lot of trickery, you know, and the way this committee of style did tinker with the punctuation, the spelling, like the use of capital letters versus lowercase letters, which really, I like the word that Al uses, the hoodooed the people.
Yeah, that reeks of legalese, making up fictitious entities when you play with the capital letters like that.
Yes, and in fact, there were, George Sherman, was it Sherman? I'm trying to remember his first name. He was from Connecticut. No, I don't think it was. Roger Sherman. He did discover either a colon or a semicolon in some of the text, and he wanted it changed. And it was indeed changed, and it did change the color of one of the clauses of the Constitution. And, you know, and for the people who believe that the Constitution was conceived and created and, you know, and put forth as this example of freedom, well, let's ask on what evidence, all right? Look at the nationalist motivations of its framers. Let's look at the secrecy of its federal convention. Let's look at the guile of its checks and balances, which were basically paper mache to be painted to look like iron. All right? The wide latitude given the Supreme Court, you know, the implied powers clause, which was just huge.
Isn't that the truth?
Yep. The subterfuge of its promotion, particularly
calling or having executive order options for a president.
Right.
You just created a dictator whenever he wants to be so.
Sure. You know, look how the anti-federalists were abused and slandered their any efforts they had or that they put forth, a lot of efforts that they put forth to get the truth out in the papers was stymied or just stopped. And the anti-federalists, no, they weren't angels. They certainly had enough. They had their ne'er-do-wells amongst them. But I think there was a far greater swath of class and interest and occupation and philosophy amongst the antis than you had amongst the federalists.
Oh, yeah, a much broader representation of the actual people living in this continent.
Yeah, and like I put earlier, everybody from jail to Yale
basically
in the anti-federalist camp. And yes, you did have some elite scumbags amongst the anti-federalists too, because they certainly wanted to get their hands on the pie that the federalists beat them to.
Yeah.
Here's another aspect that might have been revealing about the Constitution's true nature, how the people were basically stroked, George Carlin used to put it, basically they had their balls stroked and they were told, oh, everything's going to be okay. Okay. And look at how hurriedly the ratification schedule took place. I mean, these guys were in such a hurry to railroad this thing through.
Now, didn't you mention, set me straight on this, that they originally started the process of voting on it, and then Rhode Island balked and said, no way, and that's when they really kicked it into gear and ramrodded it through. Is that correct?
Hey, yes, it is. Of course, the Bill of Rights was sort of a bone thrown to the people. And, yes, the extortion of sovereign Rhode Island, where Washington said, if you guys don't jump on board, we're going to embargo you, we're going to hold off trade with you. The governor of Rhode Island did indeed send a letter to Washington and his cabinet, silence, no response. Washington refused to visit the state, I believe in 1790 when he was traveling in New England. So he was snubbing them already. North Carolina was kind of a philosophical brother to Rhode Island, but they did cave late, but they did, acquiesce prior to Rhode Island's acquiescence.
Mm-hmm.
And here's another thing. Americans, they didn't even know what went on in the convention until 53 years later.
Really?
When Madison's notes were published in 1840.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Now, Lysander Spooner, this was in Essay 7 of No Treason. He wrote this in 1870. Now, this is what he said, quote, if any considerable number of the people believe the Constitution to be good, why not sign it themselves and make laws for and administer them upon each other, leaving all other persons who do not interfere with them in peace? Until they have tried the experiment for themselves, how can they have the face to impose the Constitution upon, or even to recommend it to, others? Plainly, the reason for such absurd and inconsistent conduct is that they want the Constitution not solely for any honest or legitimate use it can be of to themselves or others, but for the dishonest and illegitimate power it gives them over the persons and properties of others. Unquote. So the state swells up, the people diminish. Can we really call this liberty?
Yeah. Wow. Well, Spooner was really ahead of his time.
He was way ahead of his time. And I hear these people say, we need to get back to the Constitution. We need to get back to the Constitution. Boys and girls, that's been the problem all along, is that we've had the Constitution.
Yeah, there you go. Bingo.
There was a warning. How are we doing for time, Theo?
We got, 20, 25 minutes, something like that.
Okay, all right. there was a senator, 1789 to 1791, he was serving, and he had some pretty prescient comments. Let me see if I can find them here. Let's see. Yes.
What time period?
1789 to 1791.
Okay.
Okay. He served a 2-year term as one of Pennsylvania's first senators. Okay. And this was from his diary and other notes. The diary of William McClay and other notes on Senate debates. And I do have a link that I will send to you and Al, a URL that has more of his works.
Okay.
June 14th of 1789, my mind revolts in many instances against the Constitution of the United States. Indeed, I am afraid it will turn out the vilest of all traps that ever was set to ensnare the freedom of an unsuspecting people. Treaties formed by the executive of the United States are to be the law of the land. To cloak the executive and with legislative authority is setting aside our modern and much boasted distribution of power into legislative, judicial, and executive. Discoveries unknown to Locke and Montesquieu and all the ancient writers. It certainly contradicts all the modern theory of government, and in practice must be tyranny, unquote. Now, after 2 years in the Senate, this is what he wrote, February 14, 1791, quote, the general power to carry the Constitution into effect by a constructive interpretation would extend to every case that Congress may deem necessary or expedient. Should the very worst thing supposable happen, notably, the claim of any of the states to any of the powers exercised by the general government, such claim will be treated with contempt. The laws of the United States will be held paramount to all their laws, claims, and even constitutions. The supreme power is with the general government to decide in this, as in everything else, for the states have neglected to secure any umpire or mode of decision in case of the differences between them. Nor is there any point in the Constitution for them to rally under. This may give an opinion, but the opinion of the general government must prevail, etc. This open point, this unguarded pass, has rendered the general government completely uncontrollable. With a fleet and army, which the first war must give us, all of future will be chimerical, unquote. Now, you talk about an accurate prediction.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't the government of today, that we have today, pretty much uncontrollable? I vote yes. Yeah.
It amazes me that people think that it's just the other party. It's their fault.
Well, ooh, yeah.
Short memory.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny, the kismet, the propinquity, some of the descriptions that Al has laid out and in the words he's used are very apropos. I got an email and I still get the Kill Raghead for Christ emails every now and then, but I got one that talked about the Russian bear and how dangerous the Russians were. Well, what I'm going to do next week, this was at work at the office, I'm going to get that article about the Russian delegation that came to the United States during the Civil War.
Oh, well, both.
I'm going to slap that one on them and say
both. Yeah. Again, Twilight Zone history. Yeah, there was the Tsar of Russia during the war between the states sent. And this also ties into the fact that France and Britain were extremely close to jumping in that fray and doing so on the side of the Confederacy, especially that invaded Mexico and was going to work their way up had they not been defeated by Juarez.
Mm-hmm.
But the Tsar then, he got his nose bloodied in the Crimean War a decade earlier or something like that. And
I
so
believe
he,
so.
He wanted another round, and he knew that in that Crimean War, the British, believe it or not, at that time, the Russians had the superior ships. The British had more ships, but the Russians had superior ones, more maneuverable. However,
they
in that
quality.
They had the quality, but in the Crimean War, they couldn't use their navy because the Brits got the jump on them and bottled them in to their ports, so they couldn't leave their ports. So in order to avoid that the next time around, 10 years later, the Tsar of Russia sent his fleets. He sent one to San Francisco. He sent the other one to New York. And you can read daily papers about that from that time. And it was actually celebrated nationally because they were given a parade in New York. They were welcomed as heroes because it was known that they were here to back up the Union. And in San Francisco, they even saved lives and put out a fire and saved American lives, the Russian sailors did. So they were welcomed as heroes there. And so they were our allies then. And we don't like to talk about that history now, though.
No, well, I believe that Gideon Wells, and maybe Abe himself said, thank God for the Russians. And I would have to say that in the course of the history of the United States, Russia is probably one of our greatest allies.
Yeah, believe it or not, yes.
If not the greatest.
Definitely in the 1800s.
Yep. And, of course, you know, the Cold War history that we were all fed, particularly, you know, in the 70s and 80s and the 60s, you know, when I was growing up. You know, it was the evil empire, it was the Soviet Union. And I thought about...
That's the boogeyman, though, I mean...
Yeah, and why, you know, what better way to sort of paper over the concept of the totalitarian that the elite scumbags want than by removing these places as showcases for the kind of collectivism that we're all looking for.
Hmm.
Well, geez, East Germany and Poland and the Eastern European bloc, Russia, you know, they're specific and concrete examples that we can point to that, you know, okay, well, this is what the elite scumbags really want for all of us. You know, now that they're gone, it's a lot harder to put your finger on it. It's like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall.
Yeah.
And that's really where we're going towards is a collectivist neo-feudalism.
Yeah,
whereas
feudalism.
We're all going to be equal. We're all going to be equal, but we're all going to be equal like, who knows, I don't know.
Or like dogs, that's how.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And I looked at the you know, the patriots, the patriotards, I like to call them, and trying to, you know, get all this, you know, the quote freedoms back and get back to the Constitution, all this, I kind of liken it to trying to pick up a turd by its clean end. And
yeah.
I see the futility of it. And, it, you know, I have to tell you about an aha moment I had about totalitarianism, speaking of totalitarianism.
Uh-huh. Yeah, let's hear it.
There was a National Geographic Explorer program that was done, and I'll state for the record that I'm not the biggest fan of National Geographic, at least as far as their energy philosophies go. I believe they are owned by Shell. Is it Shell Oil Company that owns National Geo, or they have a very large...
Some form of big oil
interest? I'm sorry, what?
They're definitely controlled by some form of big oil monopoly.
Yeah, I noticed that... And this is what I wanted to mention, that if you look at the National Geographics of the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, you see many products that were made in the United States. You know, radios, beds, cars, tools, phonographs, just a lot of the amenities and accoutrements of our modern life. And now, and I do get National Geographic, okay? And I look at the ads now, and it's either for pharmaceuticals, insurance. You know, you do see some of the ads for the clean energy, like the solar power, the wind power. But notice that anything to do with a real exotic high-energy technology that is available but suppressed, they won't touch with a 10-foot pole. I will give them. I will give them this. Their demographic information and research is second to none. You know, they'll go say to the, you know, the island of Borneo, and they'll talk to the natives. Their work there, I think, is excellent. Which brings me to my aha moment. Inside North Korea, I don't know if you've seen this, but it came out in 2007, late February. It's about 2 hours long. It's a documentary. And this gal, Lisa Ling, she gained access to North Korea. She posed as a medical coordinator. Now, there was this doctor that went along, a Dr. Sanduk Ruit, R-U-I-T, and actually was an eye surgeon, or is an eye surgeon. And somehow they got into North Korea, and they were surreptitiously photographing what was going on. This surgeon operated on something like 1,000 people within I don't know how many days. It was just a really balls-to-the-wall schedule. Well, they operated on all these people, and after all the operations were done, you know, people had these people had cataracts and different eye ailments, whereas they were either legally blind, what we would consider legally blind, or totally blind. Well, they finally met in this giant hall at the end, or large, not giant, but good sized hall, which could hold a few hundred people, where the cameras were there, and I don't know if the minders, these government minders who basically were with the team everywhere they went to keep an eye on them, you know, they were under constant supervision and being watched just about all the time. When the team and the surgeon took the blindfolds, the bandages off the eyes of these North Koreans who'd been blind for months and years in many cases, did they thank the medical team who restored their eyesight? No.
Huh.
They went right to the pictures on the wall of the two leaders of Korea. I believe it was Kim Jong-un and Kim Jong-il. I don't know if I've got the names exactly right. They went right to these two photographs on the wall, singing the praises, tearfully joyful, thanking the great leader for giving them their eyesight.
Well, that's right out of 1984.
You talk about totalitarianism, fear, basically a religion of sorts, and what I consider to be that episode of the Twilight Zone. And then I thought about something. How different is that? Okay, it's a matter of degree to the parchment worship that we employ in this country of the founders. Is it really all that different?
Probably.
I had to ask myself that.
Yeah.
You know, okay, fine, it's a matter of degree. You know, we certainly don't have anybody with a gun to our heads saying you have to worship the founders or anything like that, but consider some of the chat rooms.
You don't have to, but you're encouraged to. Remember, there's that painting above the Capitol Dome, the apotheosis of Washington, where they turn him into a god. So we're
mm-hmm.
encouraged to worship Washington, but we don't have to, no.
Well, I guess where I'm going with is that we are our own troops, so to speak. In North Korea, it's the government. In this country, it's your own compatriots, the people who say, well, we believe in the First Amendment, we want this, we want that, we believe in freedom. Aren't they the first ones to want to put your head on the pike if you challenge their view of the founders?
Oh, yeah, the patriotards are all over that, yeah.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
You're
sure,
challenging.
It's a matter of... Go ahead.
You're challenging their gods, their mythology.
Right, and I'm not saying that, you know, we're like North Korea. I mean, we have a hell of a lot better off than they do in so many different ways. And it is a matter of degree. But I guess where I'm going with this is that myths and ideas are hard things to divest from.
You know what? I agree. And, Eric, the tendency will be for Americans to think, well, we're better than North Korea because we're inherently better as a people. I don't believe that. I believe Well, as if you read Democracy in America by Alexis de Tocqueville, back in the early 1800s, it was his belief that really the main reason that America was, the Americans had so much liberties back then, had mostly to do with geography. We lucked out, and we had oceans protecting us on both sides, and wimpy neighbors north and south. And the Aborigines were wimps, too. So we had this vast expanse of frontier, where, as you indicated earlier, if the government started getting too encroaching upon people, they could just move, go west. And so, you know, if the U.S. had been a cramped, crowded country like North Korea with threatening neighbors on every side, I think the American people would be just like the North Koreans. That's my opinion.
I can't disagree with that. There was another anti-federalist who saw what came of this whole thing, and his name is Edmund Randolph. And on the 10th of October, 1787, he wrote, quote, "I hope that this was the Virginia delegation will be seconded, one, in causing all ambiguities of expression to be precisely explained, two, in rendering the president ineligible after a given number of years, three, in taking from him the power of nominating to the judiciary offices or filling up vacancies which may there happen during the recess of the Senate by granting commissions which shall expire at the end of their next sessions, four, in taking from him the power of pardoning for treason at least before conviction, five, in drawing a line between the powers of Congress and individual states, and in defining the former so as to leave no clashing of jurisdictions nor dangerous disputes, and to prevent the one from being swallowed up by the other under cover of general words and implication, six, in abridging the power of the Senate to make treaties supreme law of the land, seven, in incapacitating the Congress to determine their own salaries, and eight, in limiting and defining the judicial power." This was to the Speaker of the Virginia House of Delegates. You know, and Sentinel, he wrote, you know, he talked about that in his 12th essay, you know, about the supreme national government. I mean, and there were the Federalists, they wanted to completely get rid of the states. And
Washington, in effect, did that. Remember, in 1791, James Montgomery covers this in "The United States is Still a British Colony." One of the first things George Washington did as president, and it was in response to that whiskey rebellion, Eric, was he initiated what he called, or what his supporters called, district states. He created a legal fiction, it's called district states, to supersede the geographic states. In effect, what he did is he extended the aegis, the authority of Washington, D.C., over all of the geographic states. And
That's correct.
He somehow used that as a justification to that's what enabled him to call out the federal troops on the whiskey rebels. However, Montgomery writes that he constitutionally didn't even need that. He had the militia, I guess, but
He did. He traveled with a lot of militia troops during the rebellion, and one of the main gripes of the whiskey rebels, and it was a lot more widespread than we've been told, the whiskey rebellion, because the one of the effects of the Judicial Act was to create that district, which basically covered Pennsylvania. So now somebody would have to be dragged hundreds of miles to be tried, whereas before it was, say, through a local magistrate or judge. That was one of the issues. That was one of the big problems that the inhabitants had. I picked up a new book today that I did mention to you and Al, and it is called The Constitution That Never Was, How the American People Have Been Conned by Lawyers. And the author is Ralph Borasuski, and it's pretty interesting, and he does have a Constitution of No Authority. I don't know if this is Spooner's work that he does include in here. But it's quite interesting, and
I like the title already.
I have yet to read it, but Kenneth Royce does quote from it in Hologram. So I'm looking forward to reading that, and I, you know, do want to get into some for future installments. I'd like to get more into the Whiskey Rebellion because there is so much to this, and just I'm finding out just how widespread it was. Many of the American people were upset with the Constitution, and it was a lot more than just excise taxes or taxes on whiskey. It was the districts. It was the heavy-handed tactics coming out of Washington. It was the heavy-handed tactics coming out of his administration. You know, Hamilton's hijinks. There were many things involved here, and it was starting to spread, and naturally the elites were getting pretty panicked about it. What I wanted to do was end on Federalist number 23. This is by Brutus. Alexander Hamilton spoke of the necessity for an energetic government. Brutus replied is taken from the 7th and 8th essays of Brutus in the New York Journal, January 3rd and 10th of 1788. And I'll read from a paragraph.
Okay.
Quote, "The European governments are almost all of them framed and administered with a view to arms and war as that in which their chief glory consists. They mistake the end of government. It was designed to save men's lives, not to destroy them. We ought to furnish the world with an example of a great people who in their civil institutions hold chiefly in view the attainment of virtue and happiness among ourselves. Let the monarchs in Europe share among them the glory of depopulating countries and butchering thousands of their innocent citizens to revenge private quarrels or to punish an insult offered to a wife, a mistress, or a favorite. I envy them not the honor, and I pray heaven this country may never be ambitious of it. The Tsar Peter the Great acquired great glory by his arms, but all this was nothing compared with the true glory which he obtained by civilizing his rude and barbarous subjects, diffusing among them knowledge, and establishing and cultivating the arts of life. By the former he desolated countries and drenched the earth with human blood. By the latter he softened the ferocious nature of his people and pointed them to the means of human happiness. The most important end of government, then, is the proper direction of its internal police and economy. This is the province of the state governments, and it is evident, and is indeed admitted, that these ought to be under their control. Is it not then preposterous and in the highest degree absurd, when the state governments are vested with power so essential to the peace and good order of society, to take from them the means of their own preservation?" Unquote. The antis knew what was happening. Not many people were aware of this giant bombshell that was going to be dropped on the people. And I think the thing that galls me the most, much like yourself and Al, was how the people were tricked into giving up their liberties. When you had these founding fraudsters going down to Pennsylvania saying, well, we're just going to tweak the articles. They lied from the start.
Yep.
They threw them out and instituted a government which was basically in tow to the very elites that we see today, carrying on the tradition of greed. It's all about the money.
Well, explain to me why that enhances your foreign policy credentials.
Well, it certainly does, because our...
These go to 11.
Our next-door neighbors are foreign countries. They're in the state that I am the executive of.
These go to 11.